Okay, so he got... Right, and so he was kidnapped. Yeah? Martin Luther. So he's at the Diet of Worms. And before Charles V, who sends him to die, but the German leader... The German leader of that community. Did you guys not bring your notes? Kidnaps him and takes him to the castle at Wartburg, and he's there for 10 months where he translates the Bible into German during that time. And the Reformation starts in earnest. Now, a few little interesting things about him. Is there's a convent, and 12 of these nuns have become born again, and they're wanting, essentially, as a nun, you're basically a prisoner, and they want to escape. And so Luther works out this arrangement with a fishmonger, guy who sells fish, herring, to the convent. So he brings in his normal load of fish in these big barrels, and then they put the nuns in the empty barrels, and they sneak them out of the convent. And so then Luther and his team, they go about trying to find husbands for these wives and for these women, and they find people for all 11, but there's one particular one, Katrina von Bora. They can't find a husband for her. And so she essentially proposes to Luther. Say, well, I would marry you if you would have me. And so he agrees to marry her. And it does a lot of good for him. Philip Melanchthon, who was Luther's partner, said about the marriage, he said, "We hope that this state of life, marriage life, may sober him up a little bit so that he will discard the low buffoonery that we have often censured." Do you know what buffoonery is? Yeah, acting like a buffoon. Yeah, do you know what a buffoon is? Yeah, right, just someone that's just... So he wasn't a totally serious guy. Melanchthon also said that, no, this is Luther. He said, "Before I was married, my bed was not made for a whole year, nor the sheets changed and became foul with sweat." So Katrina helped him a lot. One of the things that she did that Luther loved the most is she brewed her own beer. And so Luther loved, you know, he's a good German. You know Germans drink beer, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Water. Huh? Like water? Yeah, he was quite the beer drinker. Luther taught the five solas. Sola is a Latin word for only. And so we have sola scriptura, which means... Scripture only, sola fide, or faith only, sola gratia, grace only, sola Christus, and sola Deo gloria, God's glory, glory of God only. Now Luther began his career with a conciliatory attitude toward the Jews, but it soon turned into bitterness. And again, we're continuing this long history of antisemitism in the church. Here's a quote from Luther. He said, referring to the Jews, we are at fault for not slaying them. Rather, we allow them to live freely in our midst, despite their murder, cursing, blaspheming, lying, and defaming. Set fire to their synagogues and schools. Let their houses be destroyed and their prayer books and Talmudic writings in which such idolatry, lies, cursing, and blasphemy are taught. Their rabbis should be forbidden to teach on pain of loss of life and limb. Now, it would be Adolf Hitler that would publish and revise the writings of Luther and publish them across the nation as a true German who hated the non-Aryan races. So Luther, his anti-Semitic writings were actually used as propaganda by Hitler for the Final Solution, which eventuated in the systematic murder of at least 6 million Jews. Luther had an inflammatory style of writing, which made any type of reconciliation impossible. In the early part of the Reformation, there was a possibility that there could have been a dialogue between Luther and Rome, because the Reformation was sweeping Europe, and the papacy was losing a lot of power. And we'll talk about some of the reforms that the Roman Church will put into place as a result of this. But there was a possibility early on that maybe Luther and Rome could have talked, and there could have been, who knows what would have happened. But Luther's style of writing and his in-your-face, attack you and cuss at you style just made reconciliation impossible. So I'll give you an example of some of his writings. He said about the Roman Catholics. He said, we should take the Pope, the cardinals, and whatever riffraff belongs to his idolatrous and papal holiness, and tear out their tongues from the back and nail them on the gallows. Yeah, kind of hard to have a chat after that, isn't it? He said about Erasmus. Now, remember we talked about Erasmus, who initially supported Luther, And actually sort of laid the groundwork for the Reformation. But then when Luther actually left the Roman Church, then he stood against him. So here's one of the things that Luther said about Erasmus. He said, Erasmus is a snake, a piece of shit. The insane destroyer of the church. The inflamer of the base passions of young boys. I saw him walking arm in arm with the devil in Rome. Oh my gosh. He had a few rough edges. His spirit was saved, though. Even towards one of the other reformers, a man by the name of Ulrich Zwingli, who was one of the main people involved in advancing the Reformation. But Zwingli held to a view of communion. It's called the memorial view. In that view, nothing happens in communion. It's simply a time to remember. Now, Martin Luther held a view called consubstantiation, which we'll talk about that when we get to theology, but he actually believed that Christ was present in the elements and that there was a spiritual transformation that took place. Not transubstantiation like the Roman Catholics, but certainly different than Zwingli's view, and so they broke, and they had a lot of angry rhetoric, mostly on Luther's side. So he says about Zwingli, he says, I've bitten into many a nut, believing it to be good, only to find it wormy. Zwingli is nothing but a wormy nut that tastes like shit in my mouth. That was his favorite word, by the way. Cussing and drinking beer, that's what he liked to do. So the lesson we learn is God uses very flawed people to accomplish his purposes. Isn't that encouraging, though? Isn't that encouraging? You should be encouraged, because you fit in the category of a very flawed person. But God uses him to accomplish his will. All right, session 8 now is the Reformation and the Roman reaction. Reformation and the Roman reaction. Yes? Yeah, great. Sure.
What would you say to someone who brings up the issue of Hitler?
Yeah.
Questioning our faith, which was because of Luther.
Yeah.
We now have this.
But yeah.
What would you say to someone?
Has that come up, or are you just preparing for the future? Has that come up? Or are you just preparing?
Or yeah. I think I saw it in one post. So,
yeah.
I saw it on YouTube.
YouTube, yeah. Yeah. Percy?
When we went to Israel, that's one of the biggest obstacles we had.
Absolutely.
We cannot evangelize. We cannot
no, I understand.
Christians
yeah, no.
Because of people.
Yeah. And you can understand. And that's why I keep bringing it up as it surfaces in history, because I want you to have an awareness of it. Because certainly reaching Jewish people, although it's probably not a major priority in the Philippines, I don't know if there's too many, I don't know what the population of Jewish people are in Manila or the Philippines, it's probably not too high. But worldwide, it's a significant outreach, and there are major barriers that it's going to take the miracle of God to overcome. But I think in dealing with that issue that might come up in our community here, which would probably be Roman Catholics who are saying, see, you're a Lutheran guy, you're a Protestant guy, see what a nasty dude he is. Well, I think, first of all, I would say what Luther taught wasn't new. So we're not Lutherans, and we're not even Protestants. We're Bible-believing Christians. So what we believe dates way before Luther. So you make a separation there, you see. Because, of course, the Roman Catholic mentality is the true church is starting with Peter, right? The first pope, yeah. And that's the true church. And now we broke off from the true church. So the true church continues, but we're like the aberration. And that's just simply not the historical fact. Yeah. You know, but you're not going to change your mind on that. But I would root it. I'm not going to go down with Luther. I'm going to root my faith. I'm going all the way back. I said, oh, no. I don't follow Luther. I follow the Apostle Paul and his teachings on righteousness by faith. Luther just brought them out of the darkness that they'd been hidden because of the Roman Catholic Church. No, I probably wouldn't say that. Oh, back at you, dude. Maybe my confrontational style wouldn't work as well here in the Philippines. Huh? So I would, first of all, I would say it's a terrible tragedy. Then I'd ask him, now, you don't want to talk about any of the bad popes, do you? And some of their murder and idolatry. And it's, we don't want to go there, do we? So, yeah, so I might say to them, so are you suggesting to me that if there was major serious flaws in a religious leader that we should discount everything they taught? If that's the case, then let's just get out our history books and look at some of the popes. But we probably don't want to go there, right? And there are several different options, but I would go back and say, oh, no, Luther didn't say anything. No, I'm not following Luther. I'm following the Apostle Paul and his understanding of what Jesus taught. So that's what I'd do. Yeah. Does that help?
Yeah.
Any other questions, thoughts, comments? Okay, we're Reformation Roman Reaction Session 8, the Reformed tradition. We're going to look at several traditions that have come out of the Reformation. That was the Lutheran tradition. Now we're going to look at several others. The Reformed tradition. The Reformed tradition centers around three individuals. Primarily the first one, John Calvin. John Calvin, 1509, 1564, born in France in 1509, experienced a religious transformation around 1530, and 6 years later publishes Institutes of the Christian Religion. Now, we'll talk about John Calvin a lot in systematic theology when we get to soteriology, which is the study of salvation, because his teaching on salvation is one of the predominant messages today and one of the most controversial messages. And his teaching spawned a challenge from a fellow by the name of Jacob Arminius. And now basically the two different ways to look at salvation in the Christian church date from either Calvin or Arminius. And so we'll have a whole massive, lengthy discussion on Calvin and Arminius and those viewpoints, which will make the controversy of last session look like a little drop in the bucket. Okay, that discussion takes a whole day, generally. But a significant man, probably, if you place him, he's in the same category after the canonical writers with Augustine. I mean, he's probably right up there in the top 2, 3, 4, 5 most significant Christian thinkers of all time. So, important to know about his life. He spent most of his life in Geneva, promoting the Reformation, reforming the church. The Institutes of the Christian Religion are probably the clearest exposition of Protestant doctrine ever given. And it gave him overnight fame. And he really essentially, especially with the death of Luther, assumed the primary leadership role in Protestantism. And although he never left Geneva for a vast part of his life, people came from all over the world to Geneva to learn from him. And his teaching spread throughout the world, especially not only because of his teachings, but what they tried to do is set up a model church in Geneva. He tried to make Geneva a model community based on Augustine's City of God. The idea of taking biblical principles, what would happen if you organize an entire culture, an entire community around biblical principles? What if to discover how should we set up a government, we went to the scriptures to find the answer. What would that look like? What would it look like if we set up a social system based on the scriptures? And so what they attempted to do, and with some degree of success, is to apply biblical principles to absolutely every part of life and set up the model community there in Geneva. And it was actually the Pilgrim Fathers who came to the United States from England in 1620 and actually had gone to Geneva and been trained there. And they were taking Calvin, which was Augustine's idea, to the United States to try to set up a city on a hill. We want to set up an entire nation now that has its foundations. What would happen if this whole nation was based on Bible principles as it regarded all of life? Not just regulating what happens in a church setting, but what happens in the legislature and what happens in all the various different departments of government and education and labor. And you think about all the departments that we have here in the Philippines of departments of government. What would happen if the basic ideology for how we ran those we got from the scriptures? That was Calvin's experiment. And that's been duplicated or the attempt to be duplicated in the United States. Okay? His theology and form of church government eventually triumphed in the Protestant Church of France, the Church of Scotland, the Reformed Church in Hungary and Holland, Puritanism in England, and eventually New England. So, hugely influential man. You'll hear a lot more about him, especially when we get to theology. Now, Ulrich Zwingli, Z-W-I-N-G-L-I. Remember, we learned about him. Martin Luther had some thoughts about Zwingli. He was born again by teaching the New Testament to his congregation in Zurich. That's Switzerland. And so in 1519, he became the pastor of the church in Zurich. And inspired by Luther, he broke with the Pope. So just a few years after the 95 Theses. Now, when Pope Adrian VI discovered what he was teaching, he forbade Zwingli the pulpit and asked the Zurich Council to repudiate him as a heretic. But instead, in 1523, the council upheld Zwingli and officially adopted the Reformation. So the official government, you see, of Zurich, which is still a city to this day, but was actually more kind of a city-state, if you understand that concept, the civil government voted to uphold and to embrace the Reformation and to break with the Pope. Now, the Reformation quickly spread to 6 districts in Switzerland, while the remaining five remained Catholic. In 1529, the hostility between the districts actually flared into civil war. And we call them provinces here. In Switzerland, they call them cantons, C-A-N-O-N. The same idea as a province, right? And the 11 cantons or provinces in Switzerland to this day are still divided among the Protestant Roman Catholic lines, all the way back to the 1500s. Still divided that way. John Knox, interesting fellow, Knox, that's K-N-O-X. Key figure of the Reformation in Scotland and the founder of Scottish Presbyterianism. Fascinating guy, ordained as a Catholic, Roman Catholic priest. He's captured by the French. You know, the French, English, Scottish, there's all these kind of wars going on. You need a scorecard to keep up with all of the wars that are taking place during this time. But France is at war with Scotland, and they capture him, and they make him a slave. But he escapes. He goes to Geneva, and he gets discipled by Calvin. And then he brings that back to Scotland, you see. And after training in Geneva, Knox went to Scotland and spent his life leading the church and shaping the character of the nation. His constant prayer was, "Give me Scotland or I die." His adversary, Mary Queen of Scots, once said, "I fear the prayers of John Knox more than an army of 10,000 men." Fascinating man. I've been to his church that he established in Edinburgh, in Scotland. My parents, my grandparents are from Scotland. And in 2005, when I went with my daughter for the Every Nation Church plant, we started a church in Edinburgh. I visited John Knox's church called St. Giles and was looking around, and they've got a lot of kind of a museum there, and so examining all the things and trying to find out where John Knox was buried. I wanted to see his tomb. And so I saw the vicar, and I began to engage in a dialogue with him and talking about the Reformation and John Knox, etc. And I asked him, because I wanted to visit the grave, I said, "So where is he buried?" And he got kind of an embarrassed look on his face, and he kind of looked around and got a little closer and whispered to me. He said, "We think he's under parking space number 2 out back." We lost him. We don't know where he is. But we think he's under parking space number 2 but nobody's quite sure. So you can go out to parking space number 2, and there's a little plaque there, but we don't know if that's actually, there's a lot of bodies under there. They don't know if that's actually his or not, but we think that's where he is. So pretty sad, because right outside the church, just a half a block away, is a huge statue to David Hume. And if you know David Hume, Scottish philosopher, one of the most significant philosophers that have shaped Western thought even to this day, a self-professed atheist. One of the first men who actually declared himself an atheist, a full, not agnostic, atheist, there is no God, and maintained that all the way to his dying breath. On his deathbed, he again vowed, there is no God. He found out a few seconds later, but he held that view all the way up to his absolute death. And there's this massive statue in honor of him. He was from Edinburgh. And yet, right next door, the great Scottish reformer, parking space number 2. That's all he gets. Now, in reaction to the reformed view of church and state, because here's what's happening, remember, is the Roman Catholic, we talked about this idea of the total Christian society and trying to no real separation between church and state. The reformers take the same idea. And now what begins to happen is communities that become Protestant, there's no separation between Protestantism and state. They just change religions. Instead of Roman Catholic and state, it's now Lutheranism or Reformed Protestantism and state, which is a dangerous idea, and it's going to cause a lot of problems. But there was a group called the Anabaptists. Anabaptists, that's A-N-A, and then Baptist. Of course, the prefix Anna is Greek, that means again, to baptize again. Advocated passivism and opposition to state churches. They rejected the hierarchy of the church and the authority of civil bodies in religious matters. Because of this, they were accused of sedition and heresy by civil and religious leaders, Protestant and Catholic. They were hunted, persecuted, and often martyred. So while the Catholics are persecuting Protestants and burning them as heretics, and the Protestants are actually burning Roman Catholics, John Calvin actually did that in Geneva. Yeah, both the Protestants and the Catholics are burning Anabaptists. So if you're a Protestant, the only danger is the Catholics might burn you. If you're a Catholic, the only danger is the Protestants might burn you. But if you're an Anabaptist, you got them coming from both sides. You might get burned by a Protestant or a Roman Catholic. Which is, obviously it's terrible, right? But they wanted to return to the early church. See what they said, the reformers haven't gone far enough. They're still holding on to many of the wrong ideologies and ideas that we embraced during the Middle Ages. And so they rejected infant baptism. But you see, Lutherans and Presbyterians and people from the Reformed tradition, they still baptize infants to this day. But the Anabaptists said, no, you don't baptize a person until they're actually born again. Okay, which is what we would believe. So a lesson we learned, it is essential that the church has a right view of its relationship with the state. Now we'll talk about the Anglican Reformation. Okay, our main character, one of the most famous people in history, is Henry VIII. Henry VIII, born 1491, 1547. And seems like we can't get enough of Henry and his escapades. We like movies, and even there was the most recent one was about Anne Boleyn, right? And And so Elizabeth, his daughter, and Mary, and we just can't get enough about Henry VIII. What a fascinating character. He was an ardent Roman Catholic who had received the title Defender of the Faith by the Pope for his polemic against Luther entitled The Seven Sacraments. Now, you know what a polemic is. It's a written attack against somebody's position. So Henry wrote an attack against Luther. And the Pope was so happy he gave him an official title, Defender of the Faith. Now, it's interesting to this day when an English monarch is coronated, there are many titles that they have, you know. The English monarch is not only the ruler over England, but like 19 different other nations. He or she currently is actually has some kind of official role as the sovereign monarch. And when they are coronated, they read off this massive list, and it's a very extensive list that goes on and on for pages and pages and pages and pages. And one of the designations still to this day is Defender of the Faith, given to the English monarchs by the Roman Catholic Pope, which is fairly ironic. So Elizabeth II, the current monarch, who has just experienced her double jubilee, 60 years in as the monarch, if she ever dies, which if anybody's going to live forever, and if Charles ever actually gets to the throne, although I'm sure the English people would rather skip him and get to his son, but if he actually is coronated, he's already officially declared that he's going to make a slight adjustment to this title. That the English monarchs have been coronated since the 16th century, and yet Charles is going to make a distinction. Instead of being coronated as Defender of the Faith, he's changed it slightly. It's now going to be Defender of Faiths. Plural, which is a very significant and postmodern distinction, you see. No longer is the idea that there is a faith, a right view, but now we just defend everybody's right to believe and practice whatever they believe, which is interesting. But Henry starts his career as a devout papist and a devout supporter of the Roman Church. But he's at a place in the southern part of England called Kent, a place called Hever Castle, which is a beautiful castle. I visited my last visit to England in 2008. Interesting castle, and that has a double moat, which is fascinating. A lot of the English castles no longer have a working moat, but this one still has its moat, and it's got a double moat. So there's a moat right along the castle, and then a grassy space, and a double moat. It's a beautiful, fascinating castle and beautiful grounds. And while visiting there, Henry was smitten by this woman named Anne Boleyn. The Hever Castle is the historic castle of the Boleyn family. And he was immediately was love at first sight. Now, as the king, usually if he liked somebody, he just made her a mistress, right? And he did what he wanted to do and got what he was interested in. And although they didn't get everything they wanted, as the mistress of the king, there was a lot of power, there's a lot of wealth, there's a lot of good things that come along with it. So most women just went along with the process. But Anne Boleyn was smart. She was crafty and sly, and she was going for the whole enchilada. She wasn't satisfied to be mistress. And she knew how to ply her arts. She knew how to work it, if you understand. And so when Henry would show up, she would dress provocatively. She would give him the come on. She would start acting like she was interested and kind of get him worked up and then shut things down. And then get kind of cold on him again. And then start the whole process up again, and just tormenting him But she had an end in mind. She's wanting a divorce. His wife, she wants to be the queen. And she's not going to settle for mistress. And she holds to it. And eventually, Henry is just, I mean, you talk about ultimate idolatry. He's willing to sacrifice everything for this woman. And so he's got a major problem, though. His current wife, Catherine, which, let me just say, it was a fairly common thing in the Middle Ages for the Pope to grant a, what do we call them? We get them here in the Philippines. An annulment, yeah. It was a fairly common thing. And there was some good reason, okay? Catherine of Aragon had actually been married to Henry's older brother, Arthur. Arthur was the older brother. He was the heir apparent, the king. And so Catherine, who's Spanish, it's a political marriage. So they marry her to Arthur. They were married for a month, and then he dies. Now, in order for her to actually marry Henry, she had to swear that the marriage had never been consummated. Okay? And so, because of that, now she was able to marry Henry. But Henry's going to go back and say, actually, no, she lied. The marriage had been consummated. And so I was not allowed by church laws. It's the laws of consanguinity. It's who can marry whom. You understand? It's complicated, right? I don't know if you have that or what it is. But in our country, you know, first cousins, right? Officially, you can't actually marry. And all those lots of parts of Appalachia and other places where that law is not put into practice. But legally, if she had actually had sexual relations with Henry's brother, they could not marry. And so Henry could have made that point. It would have been an easy deal. But you know what the problem is? Catherine's nephew is Charles V. Charles V, remember, he's the dude that made Luther, tried to make Luther repent. He's the Holy Roman Emperor. He's also the most powerful human being on the planet. He owns most of the world, at least most of the civilized or most of the European Western world. And Catherine tells her nephew, here's what he's trying to do. And so Charles says to the Pope, if you grant an annulment, I'm coming after you. And I got more power than you. And so the Pope, his hands are tied. He cannot give Henry the annulment. And so they try every possible thing. Finally, in the end, Henry's lust for Anne Boleyn overcomes all good reason. And he breaks with the Pope. And he now becomes the head of the Church of England, called the Anglican Church. And of course, to this day, the monarch, Elizabeth II, is the official head of the English Church. Although it's just an honorary title. It's really the Archbishop of Canterbury who's the official leader. But still, she holds the official title, head of the English Church. So this is a brilliant coup for Henry because about 40% of England is owned by monasteries. Remember, we talked about how wealthy these monasteries had become. And so he dissolves them all. He says, they're now my property. And he starts selling them off to people to get money for war. Because war is coming, you see. Yeah, it's not a good thing. Yeah, I've been in the Tower of London, on the banks of the Thames there in central London. There's a memorial to Anne Boleyn where she was killed. She was beheaded, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and I think three of the wives got the same thing. And they're all at the same spot, right there in the central court of the White Tower that William the Conqueror had built in 1087. And that's where she was executed. So Henry changed very little, I'm reading from the notes now, in the Church of England. Really, all it was a political move. Nothing really changed. However, when his son Edward, your fill-in, Edward VI became king in 1547, real change and genuine Protestant doctrine was introduced in the church. Now, Edward was just 9 when he became king, but he had a protector. He had someone who sort of was the kind of the stand-in king, the real power behind him, until he reached the age of, I think, 18. And his protector was a devout Protestant, so they try to make real change now into the church. Before, there was no real change. Now, real Protestant doctrine is starting to go in. 6 years later, however, Edward died, and Mary, you probably heard of her as Bloody Mary, Bloody Mary, which to this day, the word bloody is a cuss word in England.
Yeah,
so Americans and other people that travel, they don't realize. They just say, the English have the bloody this and the bloody that. And it's pretty foul. So you would never, ever, ever say that in church or as a Christian person. You know, bloody is it's like, well, I won't tell you what it's like, but you understand. It's like, it's like this. No. She's a fanatical Roman Catholic, and she began her reign by abolishing the religious innovations of her father and brother. When she died 5 years later, Elizabeth became queen and restored Protestantism. So you see, you got this terribly confusing. First we're Roman Catholics, okay? And now we're Anglicans. And then Henry dies, now we're Protestants. Wow. 6 years later he dies, now we're Roman Catholics again. 5 years later she dies, now we're Protestants again? If you've seen the movie Braveheart, it starts with the Oxford martyrs who are being burned at the stake under Bloody Mary. She gets that designation because she probably burned 300 men and women at the stake during her reign. And remember, I think I told you there's two different ways to be burned at the stake, right? Yeah, there's the good way and then there's the bad way. The good way is they make sure that the wood is kind of damp, so there's a lot of smoke, and you die from asphyxiation, which happens fairly quick. And it's a terrible way to die, right? Because you can't breathe, you know, smoke inhalation. But it's not like actually being burned to death, which takes quite a long time for the human body to burn and to actually be decomposed. Yeah, it takes 8 hours at 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit to completely reduce a human body to dust. So it takes a long time. And so she just burned them without any mercy, extreme pain. That's why she gets named Bloody Mary, because of that. Although, during Elizabeth and Edward's reign, Roman Catholics received the same kind of treatment. But remember, the winners always write history. And so you find out more about what they have to say. Puritanism, and we'll end this, our last thought. Puritanism was a Calvinistic movement that sought to purify the Church of England from within. They stressed rigid morals, church discipline, and conversion as a prerequisite to church membership. At this point, under Elizabeth, Protestantism takes over, but it's a pretty modified light. It's kind of Protestantism light, you know. But what happens is real believers now in England want to actually purify the Church of England. And they're called Puritans. So they want to get rid of all the Roman Catholic leftovers and really have a pure John Calvin-like, Geneva-like church. Okay? They never fully win. And so then our last point, there were those who saw the process of reforming the Church of England from within as entirely hopeless. They separated from the church. We call them the separatists. Some going to Holland and others to the new colony of Massachusetts in North America. So what we call the Puritans or our Pilgrim Fathers, it's our reference, they were separatists. They had broken from the official church, and they did not think the Puritan strategy would work. So they want to go to and start afresh again. So we'll end there, that one, and a good way to end. And I guess we'll pick it up in August or September, huh? All right, enjoy your summer off.